iRadio 76 proudly presents the 515 Show with your host, John Sarver. Who's at the 515 door today?
Well, this is going to be easy, only because you start off with calling the wrong number, but everything turns out dandy. That's the way we like doing things here at CKWI Radio 76, and that's why Daniel the intern will be subsequently let go in an hour and 20 minutes. So, this is going to be fun, only because we have a lady on the line right now that does more than you. I mean, figure this one out. You feel like going to Bonneville? Sure. You feel like drag racing a 200-mile-per-hour funny car? Why not? Okay. It is. So, Christopher said, coming to us all the way from the Suzy Q 1957 funny car, I believe it's alcohol, too, isn't it, Sue?
Yes, it is. It's alcohol.
Absolutely. This is going to be fun, only because... Sue, how does somebody get to go to drive at Bonneville? What did you drive at Bonneville?
An 82 Camaro with a small block production car. And I guess you get to do that if you know the right people.
I mean...
Be part of the team.
So the team said, okay, who around here wants to drive the Camaro? And you go, well... I'll do it.
Well, actually, my husband was part of a three-man team that started racing in the 90s.
Yeah.
And they had all been in the driver's seat and all took their turn getting in the 200-mile-an-hour club. And I started going out there in 94, actually, on my honeymoon. That's where I spent my honeymoon. And I was just getting introduced to the whole racing scene, and
yeah.
After going out there for a year or two as a crew member, the guys all kind of put their heads together and said, you know, we've all had our turn in the car, let's give Sue a shot at it. So it was my turn to be a rookie and get my licensing done in, it was 1995, actually.
And you're looking at these guys and you're going, me? Or were you saying, give me those keys, darn it, before you hurt yourselves?
Well, it's somewhere right in between there. I didn't actually originally think they would let me get behind the wheel of that car. It was
yeah.
pretty special. When they started talking about it, I was extremely excited about the opportunity.
I mean, was that part of the honeymoon? It was like, look, sure, I'll marry you, but on our honeymoon, I want to go to the Bonneville South Flats?
Well, it was more like...
what a romantic you are.
Well, you know, one of the first dates we went on was to a drag race, my first drag race ever. I didn't grow up around this stuff. It was all new to me. And another date, we went to Frank Holly's drag racing school down in Florida and licensed to drive a rear-engine dragster. So it kind of progressed from there. So it just kind of made sense. One of my wedding gifts was a fire suit, so. not the usual wedding gift.
Okay, so where do you go to register for your bridal stuff?
I guess RJS.
Yeah, I would guess so. I mean...
Simpson, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how did you do this? I mean, okay, so one day you see this guy and he says, okay, madam, how about a date? And you say, sure. And he goes, so, well, you want to go to the drags? You say, what the heck is that? And he says, come on, it's loud, it's noisy, and it's fun. And you say, okay. And then ever since then?
Oh, yeah, ever since then. We've been at it ever since then. I guess I got hooked right away.
I mean, were you hooked when you were watching these and said, you know what, I could do that? Or were you more curious about what goes on with all that? I mean, what took you into the pits?
Well, actually my first drag race was at Milan Dragway right here in Michigan. And Shirley Muldoney was actually do an exhibition race that weekend. So that's how long ago it was. She was still driving. And I was just so impressed. And, you know, my husband was, I think he at first was like, would she even like this stuff? When I did and I got excited about it, it was, you know, from there we kind of said, we kept putting our heads together, and he said, would you like to learn how to drive one of those things? And I'm going, really?
Really?
Yeah, and it scared me, but at the same time, it was one of the kind of sketchy things, but I got to try it.
Yeah, okay, so how many times have you skydived in your life?
Never. I don't like heights. I can take the speed, but I don't like speed going down.
All right, because we're trying to figure out where this pattern came from. I mean, when you were a kid, I mean, did you ride motorcycles or something? I mean, where did this all of a sudden need for speed kick in?
Well, actually, no, but I did go to school to become a technician. I actually went through a program and went to work for General Motors, and I was ASE certified, and that's how I met my husband. He was the Snap-on tool guy.
Ooh! Chinga! Oh!
And I was teaching the guys how to fix cars, so I had an interest in cars, but it hadn't evolved into the hot rods and high speed until he started to put that in my head.
Yeah, but I mean, really, way to go to hit gold dirt. I mean, you could have had the Mac Man or the Craftsman guy, but
no.
Snap-on dude, ching!
Yeah, absolutely.
For those who don't know, and I would be surprised if you didn't, but Snap-on tools are the only tools that we ever use. But you want that 9/16 wrench? Here, we can pull a loan for you. You know, I mean, these things are not cheap. When you saw the Snap-on truck show up, like every Friday, you just handed them your paycheck. Because Snap-on tool, in my estimation, we're not selling anything here or anything, but, I mean, they were or are the finest tool. I mean, you just take a Snap-on ratchet, and you just hear that little click, and it's like precision all the way. Way to go. So the Snap-on guy goes over to you and says, hey, Sue. And that's it? I mean, that's how the romance begins?
Yes, I guess more or less. There's a lot more to it.
Well, I'm sure there would be. Yeah. But still, way to go.
It's been a 26-year ride so far, and it's still going good.
So what, you got married when you were 3? Okay.
Oh, hey.
You know, where in General Motors land were you working at?
At the Warren Tech Center. I started there, and I moved around in the company. I had a lot of different jobs.
Yeah.
But I started out as a dyno technician working for Pontiac Motors. That was my first job. And progressed from there, and I was with the AC Delco division for a while as a regional service sales manager. I was always in service and sales except for one short stint where I was in motorsports marketing, of all things.
Hoorah!
it was a good ride. I've been retired for, 11 years.
All right, so you retired when you were 40. But here's the scoop. I mean, where were you turning a wrench in the tech center?
Well, I was actually teaching.
Yeah.
After I got my experience as a technician with Pontiac for a while, I applied for a job and actually went in as a employee in training. And Warren Tech Center used to have a school on the northeast campus, which all the technicians in the area from the dealerships, the GM dealerships, would come and get their training.
Yeah.
And we come up with a new Corvette or a new fuel system or air conditioning system. They'd have to come to school and learn all about it. And that was, I was one of, I think we had 8 instructors there. So
I'm thinking that this probably wasn't an all-woman team.
No. out of about 160 instructors or more around the country, And then with the contract employees and the ones that taught at the schools, probably 300. I think I was one of four women at the time.
Four?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It was a rarity. And I had to prove myself, that's for sure.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is that even with Carrie Ann Beebe that we've had on here and Krista Schneider that we've had on here, all of them say, as we jump a little bit, that when you're a female and you're in drag racing, the stories they could tell you of things that were, like you would swear it was 1951 in the South. You know, that folks would look at you as a woman and would sometimes not give you the equal fun ride as they would give anybody else.
I would say my experience in my years of racing, and I guess I've had, 26 years of racing.
Yeah.
I've had very little of that. Usually the initial, if you show up at a track and nobody knows you and they don't, you know, they don't recognize your car or know anything about you, their first assumption is you probably aren't very good at what you do. They're reluctant to necessarily go up against you in case you don't know what you're doing going down track. But once you make a couple of passes and you demonstrate that you have some competency, you know, it seems, my experience is, you gain people's respect pretty fast at the drag strip, these days anyways, and I've always felt like I fit in and have been well accepted and treated very well by my competitors.
That's amazing. I mean, that says a lot because, I mean, the stories that we were hearing, it was like, what decade are we in? You know, I mean, it was almost like the Muldowney-Garlitz, quote-unquote, feud, you know, that they had.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, for the 60s, you know, but I mean, for in the 90s and 2000s and stuff, it sounded so out of place. You know,
yeah, I mean, like I said, it has not been my experience. I get to the drag strip, and I feel like I'm just one of the racers.
Yeah, well, I think it's how you present yourself also. But, I mean, all the women should not have to go through, you know. I mean, it sure is nice when you show up with, like, a 14-drawer Snap-on full set. This person
well,
knows what
also,
she's doing.
It also to garner a lot of respect when you show up with a funny car.
Yeah, you know, and that's, well, I mean, all these cars that the ladies that we've had on, they're not racing Omnis, you know, by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
And so the stuff that's, you know, you're the only one that, you're right, that has run a funny car. But let's get back to Bonneville for just a second, if you don't mind. All right,
sure.
You get married, on the honeymoon you go, gee honey, wouldn't it be nice and romantic to go on a cruise? No. Catalina Island? No. Bonneville Salt Flats? Why, sure, let's pack the bags. I mean, is that how it went? I mean, how do you go on your honeymoon? Honeymoon. This is like something that we've seen a ton of movies for, and none of them involve a Camaro in Salt Lake City.
I guess we didn't have anything more exciting to do that. That seemed pretty exciting to me. I've never been there.
Okay. That makes sense. Makes great sense to me. Okay. It's like, when I get married? Yeah, okay, a week afterward. You want to set a land speed record? Why, sure, okay. Nothing else better to do. All right.
Well, you know, there's a lot more challenges to just, when you first go to the Bonneville Salt Flats, you see cars going down the track, you think, okay, this is all about just trying to drive the car 200 miles an hour.
Oh, no, it's not. Yeah, but
a lot of people don't know you have to license, you have to take four passes in the car.
Yeah.
And you have to get what they call a rookie license, and you start out just going like 125, then you can go 150, then you can go 175, and once you've demonstrated you know how to do all those things, you can go 200 miles an hour. So you can't just go out there and drive 200 miles an hour without the credentials, I guess. And, you know, we had plans that didn't always pan out. The year I was planning to make my first attempt at setting a record. And so, you know, setting a record is you go down and you actually break the existing record of a similar car in the similar class. So you have to go faster than the last person did in that class. And it's based on the car you're driving and the cubic inches of the engine, what kind of fuel you're using, all that stuff. Once you do that, that's still not, you're still not there. You now have to go to impound, wait overnight, make a second pass on the same track the next morning, and back it up. And the two-way average is what your record will be.
Right. Now, you broke a record, didn't you?
Yes.
All right. Want to tell the folks what you did?
Well, the first year I was out there, I was attempting in a different class than I actually ended up in. I was 230 miles an hour qualified with the impound.
Okay.
The next morning on my return run, around the time I was hitting that top speed again, the car spun out.
With you in it?
Well, oh, yeah.
Oh, I would have walked away.
It's really, you don't have any barriers or walls around you, so you lose perspective. My eyes went to the edge of the windshield, and I was watching the hood, and the air is just fluttering the edge of the hood, and I just knew the hood was going to fly off the car, come up and hit the windshield, break the windshield, and you're going to laugh. The thing going through my head at that moment was, these guys are never going to let me drive this car again.
Yeah, but for folks who have never driven on that alkaline bed, that's not like driving on a nice concrete I-75 brand new stretch of concrete, as we should say.
You know,
it's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, what happened, I mean, it was, in my mind, it was a long time before the car stopped. Because what happened was, the car started to sashay. That year, the salt wasn't so good. The tires got into some ruts, and I was a lot smaller than the other three guys that had been in the car before, and so my lighter weight in the front of the car actually allowed the front end to lift a little bit more than normal, and that caused me to lose traction, and the back of the car started to sashay. I could feel it wagging, and it was like, uh-oh, this isn't good. So you don't, when you're going over 200 miles an hour, you don't just pull your foot off the gas pedal like you might do going down I-75, you know, to slow down, because that would definitely unload the car immediately. So I backed off the throttle a little bit. The car didn't help. It was almost like it wagged a little bit, and each time it came back, it went out of line a little bit more. I could just feel the back of the car going a little farther and a little farther, until finally it just spun around. And after it spun, came to a stop. So didn't hurt anything at all, but it was enough to make us have to come back the next year to go after the record. But I finally got it in 98.
And that record is?
213.98. 94, something like that. Anyway,
no one's going to hold you to that one. Okay.
It was with a 300 cubic inch small block Chevy with a carburetor.
And
naturally aspirated.
And you went 200 miles per hour, over 200 miles per hour.
214, yeah.
With kind of a glorified 283. Okay. So listeners want to know, what kind of rockets were you packing in that car at the time?
Well, again, between my husband and the guys on our team, they had a lot of brain power to put into that, that motor. We had the right rear end, the right transmission, and, you know, it was a manual shift transmission. It was the right combination. It was almost like a NASCAR motor. It was just a very, very high compression. And they had come up with something pretty slick to keep the air cool. So we were putting very cool air in and getting a lot of horsepower out. Just the right combination, I guess.
You know, just as a curiosity, what kind of gear do you put in a diff for NASCAR? I mean, for Salt Lake City?
It was a 213.
Wow. Jeez, oh, Pete. Okay, not quick on the takeoff, but oh, boy, unlimited top end. Okay.
Yeah, the car doesn't take off. You can't drive away. You get pushed up. We'd have a push vehicle up to about 30 miles an hour.
And then off you go.
Let out the clutch and go, yeah.
I mean, did you have any drag chutes on this car?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I couldn't stop the... Well, the car didn't stop very well without the chutes. That happened to me once, too. On my record run, the salt would get the chutes. One of the things that's real different from the drag strip to the salt flats is the chute would get full of salt. Well, if you know anything about how salt behaves, it tends to be very... hydroscopic, and it will absorb a lot of moisture. But in the sun, the moisture bakes out. And what had happened is the chute had had enough salt on it, and it had gotten wet overnight, just naturally from, you know, absorbing moisture. And when I pulled the cord, the chute stayed as kind of a hard block. And anyway, it took an extra 2 miles to get the car to a stop, but one of the advantages of being out in Bonneville is you have more real estate to work with.
Yeah, but all right, so you pull the chute, you don't feel that tug, you don't hear the pop, and you're going, anytime now, and I'm pretty well sure they didn't have rear cameras at that time. So what did you think when the chutes didn't come out?
I thought, oh my God.
Yeah, those terms.
You have no speedometer on these cars. You do all your driving with a tachometer. So as the car, once you lift and you're in decel mode, you have no idea how fast you're going, so you don't dare turn off the course until you're really slow. So you just ride it out. You just hang on.
Yeah, I mean, Bonneville, for those who don't know, it's a unique animal all by itself. It's not like they give you a car and you just, like, drive willy-nilly wherever you want to go. They actually do have a lane there, you know, and that's where they can do the timing, and that's where and it's kind of marked out. But isn't it marked out, like, obviously, on the ground with some kind of chalk dust, right? I mean, to let you know where your line is?
They put a black line down both sides of the course. So you're driving between the two black lines, and... they're 90 feet apart, so you have a lane that's 90 feet wide.
And thanks, husband.
They put the flags at the mile markers. Yeah. And that's where the timers are. And so you know when the timed mile is 5 miles. So you know when you go through the timed mile, it's time to pull the chute.
Wow. I mean, do they give you anything that you can figure out where center is? You know, like some kind of center line or something? Or you just try to keep between the goalposts there and hit it?
Keep between the goalposts. And, of course, you know, if you don't go straight from A to B, the more you move back and forth, the less your time slip is going to be given you.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of like in a funny car. You go down the track, and if the car's moving around a lot, it scrubs off your final... time.
You know, so what kind of tires do you use? Because you see some of like those old Spirit of America kind of pictures, and the salt is caked to the tire itself.
They're Goodyear front runners. We actually had four different sized tires depending on what what we're trying to accomplish it was all based on the gears in the transmission, the tires, the size of the tires, and the cubic inch of the engine, and calculating, you know, what do we need to go this fast to break this particular record? Because over the years, we went off after, I think as a team, we set 13 records. Not all of them held. Somebody else would come along and break that record. But over the years, I think our team set 13 records.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so of the 13 that you set, can you name five?
Five records?
Sure.
Can I use my cheat sheet?
Absolutely you can. That's why I was only going to go for five, because I can't remember 13 anything. You know, so five. Yeah. Sure, use your cheat sheet. Do the whole thing, girl.
Well, we had an A production record at 225. We had a B production record at 222. A C production record at 234. A D production record at 214. Then we had some records in C fuel altered. We had records in D gas altered. C fuel altered. Let's see, the highest record I have on my list here, and I think these were most of them, 233 miles an hour, 233.742 miles per hour. They always carry it out to three digits.
Okay.
The car had been over 240. My husband had the top speed in the car several times. He was probably the most prolific driver of the team. And 243 might have been his top speed in the car. We weren't sure the car would stay on the ground at 240 or 250.
We weren't sure, but we went anyways. Okay. This hopefully was not on your honeymoon.
No. Okay. This was over. We raced that Camaro at the Salt Flats until 2004.
Wow. All right, so of all those records, how many were you driving in them?
I only actually set one record myself. I drove four different years. We took turns, different drivers, but I only actually set one record.
Wow. Well, you know, I'm thinking, you know, when we're talking about, and Daniel just sent a note, with those tires, those Goodyear tires that you had, they don't have a whole lot of traction on them, or do they?
No. They're a smooth tire. Well, they have some tread, but
yeah,
you know, it's not like a mud tire.
No. Had over 200 miles per hour. Yeah, that'd be fun. But again, for dear listeners who are out there who have never seen the Salt Flats. It's kind of like snow. It's not really like snow. But when Sue talks about how the back end would start to give a little bit, it's that same sensation of when you're driving on an icy road. And then except for on a highway, you can overcorrect a lot faster and spin around. You, on the other hand, you're going through your head. You know, note where when you were having the back end of shimmy, nowhere in your head did you say, pull the chutes. I mean, and you can't lift, and so did you think that spinning out was going to be, well, that's just how it's going to go, or were you going to try to save it?
I actually did pull the chute, because I had, one of the things that getting ready to drive, even in the funny car, it's not that different. You have to do so much mental preparation, because you can't sit and practice on the track.
Right.
The volleyball car, you're only out there for 1 week a year, so you sit in the car and you do a lot of imagining to try to go through all the scenarios. And I had asked the guys who had been driving before, you know, what happens when the car gets really out of shape? And one of the, they said, you can try pulling the chute.
Try.
But here's the thing. The chute can do one of two things.
Yeah.
It can unset the car and cause it to spin or flip over, or it can stabilize the car and help you slow down and get control of it. But you don't know what it's going to do, because never did it before. I was the only, that was the one and only time we ever spun that car out. So I did pull the chute. Ultimately, when the car got really, really loose, I decided the chute was my best chance, and I pulled it. But it's got a really long lead on it.
Yeah.
And I watched it blossom in front of me.
In front of you? Wow, as you're spinning.
I had already spun around and was looking into it when it opened.
Wow. Yeah, because you're thinking at that speed, and if you're starting to do 360s, you know, where is that chute going to end up, where it's going to finally kick its air, you know, and drag? You're right, because it could wrap around you, you know, or else it could do what technically it's supposed to do. Wow. Well, and you didn't think twice about that, did you? I mean, did you think, well, maybe if I do this, I could flip, or maybe it'd stop me. Well, let's try it anyways. I don't think you had that much time, did you?
No, there's a certain amount of instinct. And honestly, not everybody can get into these kind of situations and have
yes.
the right response. I mean, mean, really, there is a certain amount of instinct that takes over, and you have to have a certain feel that this is what I'm going to do to survive, or,
you know,
some people freeze, some people just do what comes naturally next, and I was lucky. I did what came next worked.
Yeah, because you couldn't really dance on the brake pedal at that speed doing circular motions, could you?
Oh, heck no. The brake is a dangerous thing. Turning and braking are two things that you don't want to do. You can drag the brakes a little, which is what I was doing, but it didn't work.
Yeah, but I mean, where do you get... I was going to say, yes, we know that you went down to Florida and learned how to drag race, but in a panic situation like that, that's what separates folks who want to be to folks who are pros. When stuff starts going down, you start looking for the pros. You know, I mean, for it to have natural reactions like that, it's like, I don't have time to really think this out. Let's try this anyways. I mean, were you thinking twice about pulling the chute, or it's like, it's about time?
I think it's hard to go back
that
many years and picture what was really going through my head, but I think it came naturally. It was my natural response at that point. I need to pull the chute. I just remember thinking that. I need to pull the chute.
And then once you did and the car finally stopped, obviously Safety Safari is coming up. The crew is coming up. You know, they get to your door, and the first one that opens the door says what to you?
Are you okay?
Could you answer them?
I probably just shrugged. It was I'm all in one piece. Yeah, I'm okay.
Let's do it again. God, I mean, so now when that goes on, does the sanctioning body says, okay, thanks a lot, you're done for the day, you can do this again tomorrow, or do they let you run again that same day after a cool-down period? How does that go?
You go back, they do a very thorough inspection of the car to see and try to analyze what happened. And the possibility of flat-spotting the tires and also doing something, we realized the guys were... We used to look at data very differently than today. We would actually have a printout on a spreadsheet, and it was all numbers. It was really hard to read.
Wow.
But we realized, after looking at the data for a while that night, the motor had actually run backwards when I spun, and was when the car got backwards and the tire stopped and started turning backwards, it's hard to explain. I don't even understand it myself, but that's what the numbers showed. So based on all that, there was no way we were going to run that motor again. And we were, you know, but this was Bonneville racing. Some people go out there with big, big pockets, but we had one motor in the car, and if that didn't work, we'd go back and build one over the winter and come back with another one the next year. So that was it. We were done.
Well, that's how I was thinking. I mean, how did you get sponsorship? I mean, who was your sponsor?
Oh, we didn't have sponsorship. This was, the four of us all had jobs.
And you said, gee, kids, let's get together and get a couple of Bonneville Salt Flat records. Sure, I got nothing to do on Tuesday.
Well, one of the guys owned the car, and, you know, he started racing it, and one of the guys was really smart about building motors, and, of course, Steve had some tools.
Gee, you think? God bless. I mean, the finest tools of all time, Snap-on tools, kids.
Well, and Steve had been out to the Bonneville Salt Flats with a Pontiac team that was trying to go 300 miles an hour, so he had quite a bit of experience to bring to the crew.
Yeah.
So they get together once or twice a week for the off months and work on the car and come up with something and pool their resources and...
And said, would you like to drive once in a while? I mean, what did you get to do? Because if you weren't driving, then what was your part of the crew?
I had the small hands that could get in and change the stuff. I had a little more computer expertise at the time, so I was downloading the data. I did a lot of things. I mean, you know, I packed the chutes. That was also my job, is packing the chutes.
Yeah, but if you're a certified mechanic, I mean, don't they let you open up the hood and say, okay, have at it, we'll come back after we have a Pepsi?
No. We didn't do that much wrenching out there. The motor was, it was a matter of fuel, water, refreshing the spark plugs, checking everything after a run, air pressure and the tires. There was a lot of things, but we weren't wrenching on the motor much.
Yeah,
that wasn't part of it.
But how about you and your team? That's not 35 degrees out there. You know,
oh,
I mean,
no. How
do you keep yourself? Because I'm sure you just don't get to wear a T-shirt and a pair of cutoffs and some flip-flops and drive for the record. I mean, I'm thinking you had to wear not only a couple of layers here, there, and everywhere, but it's hot in Salt Lake City.
It's hot and it's dry, and the sun reflects off the salt. One of the things that newcomers to the salt sometimes don't realize is you got to put your sunscreen on the bottom, on the inside of your legs, and the bottom of your arms, bottom of your nose. Anyway, you wear a hat and you wear long. I always wore long jeans to keep from getting sunburned.
Yeah,
and a lot of people wear a long white sleeved, you know, white shirt. It's the conditions are really uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, that's why you want to go fast, so at least get some wind going on you.
Yeah, well,
you know,
inside that car. Once you put your fire suit on and your helmet and you're strapped into the car and the windows are closed.
You know, I was just thinking, what year Camaro did you say it was in?
82. It was an 82 Camaro.
I was thinking that wasn't, I mean, it was kind of aerodynamic, but I don't really remember with the exposed headlights. I mean, was that a really aerodynamic car, or did you have to do a lot of modifications to the body?
Well, it was very aerodynamic for what we were doing, but there were a few modifications. And one of the things that made our car very unique is that we had a special set of headers, and the headers came out the wheel well. So the car, the guys dropped the whole suspension on the car, so it was just a few inches off the salt. The key was not to let a lot of air underneath the car, because you couldn't add a spoiler for production class.
Oh.
So you drop the car as low as you could off the salt, and with the headers coming out the wheel well, that made a difference. And then, I don't know what you call them, but they had little... roof rails that go down the top of the car, and that's supposed to help keep the car stable, the air moving over the top of it instead of from side to side. But
amazing. And then you say, okay, gimme. I mean, were there certain years before you guys packed up, you said, okay, this year Sue's driving, next year Bob will drive or Al will drive? I mean, did you all know, did you get there and you go, who feels like driving?
No, it was mostly planned ahead. It was based on who had driven last or who had the last record or what we were doing with the car. And the plan was pretty much set up going into the week that so-and-so was going to be the primary driver. And we rotated, so different people drove different years.
I mean,
I drove later years after 98, but I just was never successful at breaking another record.
You know, how far away did you live that you had a trailer that far to Salt Lake City?
We live in Michigan, and so it was a 2.5-day drive. And we'd usually get there middle of the day on Friday and get our pit set up. Saturday was usually tech inspection and orientation, driver's meetings. And I think they would start running on Saturday.
Wow.
Noon, and then the running would keep going until Thursday, usually, as long as the conditions were good.
You know, the weird thing is, when you showed up, did you have to, like, go over to your class? With all the other cars that looked like your cars, or did you just set up camp anywhere you wanted to, or how did that work?
There are no groupings. It's not like if you go to a drag race and the pro stocks are over here and the top fuel's over there and the pro pads are over. No, everybody pitted wherever they wanted. It was kind of a free for all, and you know, there weren't any cars that looked like yours. Every single car out there was kind of a one of a kind because almost everybody built their own. And you might be in the same class, and the cars could look as dramatically different as, you know, night and day.
I mean, did you see some, when the sun was going down, it was kind of like, you know, where it's almost decent to walk around in the salt flats. Did you take a look around at cars that were in your class and go, ah, I remember seeing them last year, or, ooh, what's this?
Yeah, I mean, we would definitely take time to walk around and talk to the other racers and watch the other teams. And, of course, some of the cars out there were already famous, and they did a program. So the first thing you could do is look through the program and see all the cars that were registered in your class.
Yeah.
But here's another thing. The car that's in your class may not run in your class all week. Most people come prepared to make some alteration to the car. Like the year I went in, that I got in 98, I got in D production. Well, then we made an alteration to the car, and my husband got in D gas altered. Same car, and it was a really minor alteration, but it had to do with the rules and what made it a gas altered production, and he ran a little bit faster, but it was basically the same car. And that's what a lot of people do, is they try to go for different records. The same car, but they might change the engine. They might, production, you have to have your fuel tank sealed. Gas altered, you don't. So you have it sealed, but it's a different classification there. You can make some changes. I think that, we covered the headlights.
That yeah, was I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was a minor change. And that just put us in a different class. You have to pay another entry fee.
Which is, I'm sure, $5.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, that's the one, when you're saying altered, are we talking like altered like an NHRA altered, or to alter the body, which you could
altered
still use
body.
That? Okay, so you still run the Camaro. So you weren't running like AAFCs or anything. I mean, you were running just the Camaro, bless your heart.
Yeah, no, it was we covered the headlights, and that was the alteration, and that made it wouldn't have qualified for a production record, but it would qualify for an altered record.
You know, if you won a production record, could you go back to GM and say, "Look what we did for, you know, in your Camaro." You know, how about a little bit of production money here, folks?
Nope. There were a couple of things. One, being that I was an employee during those years, they don't tend to support any sponsorship that way. But, you know, large corporations have to pick and choose how they spend their marketing money.
Yeah.
And they weren't, you know, in 1998, they were not promoting an 82 Camaro. So.
Yeah, well, maybe they should have gone back to that body style if it's winning in Bonneville.
Well, that's kind of the bottom line. They weren't promoting that, so there was no marketing money opportunity there.
I mean, why did you, just because we had the car body there, or was there something about that car body that you said, this is the one that we could really work with?
I think it's because our teammate, Tom, had that car. And he started modifying it to be a race car, and he had the idea to take it out to Bonneville to see what he could do. And it kind of seemed like it was aerodynamically sensible. And once they started putting motors in it that had more horsepower, more potential, we dominated the production classes for over 10 years with that car. But it was more just kind of a evolution. It was not a well laid out, you know, intentional plan to begin with.
Yeah, but it must have been fun for everybody to be gunning for you, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
She didn't even hesitate. Hell yeah.
We had people tell us all the time that that we were the ones that they wanted, that, you know, that's like, gosh, we'd like to do what you guys are doing. We want to break your record.
Yeah, well, go faster then, bub.
Yep. And they got, a lot of people got frustrated chasing us. You know, you can't dominate forever, but it was fun while it lasted.
Yeah, and then we get into the chapter of the funny car, but guess what, Sue? Our time's up.
Time.
But that's okay. Here's the story. We are fascinated by your story. We haven't even got into 1/99th of everything we kind of think, we kind of know about what you and your husband and the team do with the Suzy Q. The one question we do want to ask is, how did it become Suzy Q? Okay, we understand, Sue, but...
Well, we were planning to do Nostalgia Racing, and we were looking for a nostalgia name, and yep, I've been Suzy to my close friends and family most of my life, and there used to be a Suzy Q restaurant on Woodward Avenue that was a real hangout. And I kind of looked into the name, and it hadn't been used a lot on the race scene. So we said, we think that that's got a real nostalgia ring to it. We like the name Suzy Q. And we kind of played around with it. And we actually, our first hero card, we used a picture of the Suzy Q restaurant behind the car.
You know,
cruising Woodward with it, you know?
And that was where at? Wasn't it more North Woodward?
Yeah, it was near 14 Mile. No, 12 Mile. Oh, I just got tipped here. It was closer. I did not grow up on Woodward Avenue, but
what?
My husband did. He knows the digs there. I don't.
Okay. Well, all right. So here's the story. This year, we're taking the year off, aren't we, from drag racing the funny car?
Yes. Yep. We're taking a sabbatical this year, and we're going to be back at it next year.
Okie dokes. Now, where can people learn more about you before you come back on with us?
Well, we have a website. It's got a long it's got a long address, but I can try to give it to you. Let me see what I can do here.
Go.
It's Christofferson Racing, all one word.
S-E-N.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Dot. Uncle-Earls, EARLS.com.
Okay.
And if you go to that website, we have our history, we have photographs, we post our schedule there when we're racing, and I have a blog. I've been posting a blog about every one of our races over the years. Since 2010, so there's lots of stories there.
You know, and sponsors are who for you for the Suzy Q?
Well, we have...
Cheat.
Uncle Earl's has been one of our early sponsors. We have Diamond Pistons and Trend Performance, Total Flow, which does our heads every year. We have Kinsler Fuel Injection, Diamond, Kinsler, Trend, and Total Flip are companies that have really, really helped us put together a good package for racing.
Yeah.
And, we have a local restaurant that supports us, and we do bring the car out and put it in front of the restaurant. It's called Parker's Hilltop Brewery. It's on Dixie Highway in Waterford, and I'll tell you what, it's just been a favorite place of ours, and then they got behind us and started sponsoring us, so I like to throw their name out there, too. Anybody coming through Clarkston or Waterford, stop on Dixie at Parker's Hilltop.
How can we tell that you are in marketing, even for a small amount of time? Sue, it has been nothing but our pleasure, but I first want to say to all the CKWI Radio 76 affiliates on the line, we're running a little bit over, but that's okay. We'll make it up on the opposite side. But, Sue, come on back with us, won't you?
I will. This has been fun. Thank you.
All right. Hang on the line for just a minute. We want to talk to you. But right now, CKWI Radio 76.